and that will remain consistent into the foreseeable future is the quality of information that we're going to provide you with as the listener, as the member, as the supporter. The listeners, the members, the supporters, one of the ways that they show support is by providing financial support for the radio station to operate the way that it does. It helps us pay our staff, it supports training for volunteers, and it keeps us engaged in the community, and it keeps the programs, whether it's news and public affairs or music, high quality programs that are unique to the radio landscape here in Portland, and I would say globally. You know, we're part of a community of community radio stations across the country. It's part of a network of radio stations like us that care about what you hear as the listener. And as the listener, we know that you care about what you hear, what you tune into when you listen to 90.7 FM. And one of the ways that you show that you care is to pick up your phone during these times, during our winter membership drive, and help us reach our goal and dial 877-500-5266. You can go to kboo.fm and click on donate on the top right if you need to.
And we're going to send it to Locus Focus. Just reminding you, we're waiting to hear your calls at 877-500-KBOO.
Judy Berry, Earth First and labor activist on the need to support community radio.
Well, I guess I just want to say for the pledge drive to support your public radio stations. Down where I live, the public radio stations KMUD and KZYX have been really important organizing tools for us to even have a movement, for us to get information out that isn't filtered by the corporations. Public radio is a really precious thing, and I think that everybody should support it. So if you want to hear stuff like this on the radio, send in your money and keep it going.
Hi, this is Bob Junda from Disability Rights Oregon. Although the United Nations calls it torture, 80,000 prisoners across the United States are in solitary confinement. This includes pregnant women, youth, and people with mental illness locked in small windowless cells with no contact for up to 24 hours each day. Join us on Prison Pipeline as Disability Rights Oregon unveils proposed legislation to stop the use of solitary confinement in Oregon prisons for persons with serious mental illness. Tune in to Prison Pipeline on February 16th at 6:30 p.m.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or wilkincpas.com.
Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. With the world's easy oil supplies tapped out, the energy giant Royal Dutch Shell made an urgent $6 billion bet on finding new reserves in one of the Earth's wildest environments, the frigid Arctic Ocean off Alaska. But the hunt for extreme oil pushed the world's biggest company past its limits and was ultimately met with disaster. This morning we talk with journalist Mackenzie Funk, whose new book, Of Ice and Men, provides a definitive account of the mistakes that led up to this disaster, the corners Shell and its contractors cut, and the heroism that could not ultimately save Shell's Arctic dreams. Mac, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start out by talking about what are Shell's Arctic dreams and what's motivating them to be doing such extreme kind of resource extraction in the Arctic?
Well, it's three things. One is that the Arctic is thought to have the last big untapped oil deposits on the planet in terms of conventional supplies. I mean, this is really kind of what's left it's not fracking, and or some unconventional technique. And for that reason alone, oil companies, Shell in particular, are interested in the Arctic. There's also the fact that Shell, compared to, say, Exxon, its big rival, doesn't have a lot of reserves on its books, which is to say, like, it doesn't have a lot of money in its bank account.
Well, actually, let's define what reserves are. You describe it really well in your book.
It's a bit complex, but it's basically when an oil company goes out and finds oil, before it starts producing that oil, it can show in terms of its accounting, look, we've found X amount of oil, we have the lease to it, the government says we can drill for it, and we could pull it out of the ground when we need to. So it's sort of like a bank account for an oil company. This is what they've got that proves that they've got a future. You know, if they've got a lot of reserves, if they've got a lot of oil they've discovered, even if it's still in the ground, if they've got the right to pull it out and they think they have the technical ability to pull it out and can prove that to regulators, they can put it on their books. And then investors make decisions based on the size of an oil company's reserves. And if you're an oil company and you don't have a lot of reserves, you're scared. You need to go get more.
So wasn't there an issue?
The third thing I should mention in the Arctic is the ice pullback and the fact that it's becoming easier to drill in the high north.
Well, actually, you talk about there was a scandal around Shell's claiming of having more reserves than they had. So let's talk a little bit about what that was about.
Sure. In the early 2000s, Shell put some reserves into a category called proved reserves or proven reserves, which is to say that they said these are not just technically feasible, but economically feasible, and we can claim them for accounting purposes and in fact report them to the SEC and really put them on our balance sheet. And this is something that happens, you know, regulators look at this and decide, can they claim this as part of their net worth, basically. And they were shown to be doing some sort of tricky accounting there, what they were calling proved reserves as opposed to possible reserves. It seemed like they were claiming too much. They were basically making the future look brighter than it was for themselves. And when they had to announce that, in fact, they'd a little bit been cooking the books or at least been doing some accounting tricks, and they needed to cut back on what they called their proved reserves, it was a big scandal in financial markets. And they, you know, their CEO was forced out. Their stock price dropped, I believe, 10%, basically overnight. And they had a big problem. They suddenly didn't. Their future was not as bright as it had looked on paper.
So how did that create pressure for them to push harder to start to extract oil from the Arctic?
Well, they basically, an oil company needs to show, you know, it's like when you go to get a loan for a mortgage or something. If you're going to investors and you want your stock price to stay high, you need to show not just that you are able to produce a lot of oil or that you have a lot of gas stations. A company like Shell needs to show that 10, 20, 30 years out, they'll still be producing a ton of oil. They'll still be as big a player in the market. And keep in mind, in 2012, Shell was the biggest company in the world by revenue, I believe. And so they need to show that they are going to keep on growing and being big and being wealthy. It has nothing to do with how well they're doing at the moment, but really it's about their future. And so this gap in their accounting meant that they needed to go out there and get more oil. It's the same problem every oil company has, but on a company of Shell's scale, they really need to get a lot of oil. They need to have really big finds, and big finds are hard to get anymore, except in places like the Arctic.
Well, I was reading an article the other day about some of the struggles with the tar sands operations in northern Alberta because of the dropping price of oil, and it reminded me of some of what you wrote about Shell's pressure, that there's a lot of debt, and I wonder how this all figures in. It seems, in a way, it reminds me of a drug addiction where these oil companies can't stop producing with unconventional methods to get oil and gas because basically they're so debt-ridden to begin with. And does that also play into some of the issues that Shell is dealing with in its momentum or its impetus to go drill in the Arctic?
I'm not sure if it's debt exactly. I mean, Shell Shell doesn't lack for operating capital. It's not that it has debtors to pay so much as it has investors to please, I would say. And that it's just so big to keep something that big rolling along like we always have. That's the addiction, is the addiction more to growth, or at least to something in closing, something that's not going in reverse. And a company as big as Shell, it simply needs to find a massive amount of oil to keep on going, because it's always produced a massive amount of oil. And that's the basic issue, is that in this world, we've tapped out so much of the easy big deposits. I mean, you name it, we've gotten it. And the other thing that's happening is that national oil companies are now claiming a lot of the oil for themselves. That in the 50s and 60s, these oil companies like Shell would go out and they would be claiming some country's reserves as their own. And as you know, as the world is fractured a bit, and Russian companies, for instance, have a lot more in reserves than do the multinationals now. The Gulf companies have a ton of reserves, and these aren't available to Shell. So they're kind of scrambling. It's an energy scramble still, and it's in part because of their size. And it's just and their addiction, and all of ours really, to this kind of economy where we need to keep on growing. We need to keep producing what we always did, or we feel like we're going backwards.
Well, we're talking this morning with journalist Mackenzie Funk, who has written a new ebook called Of Ice and Men, about a rather chilling, thrilling, and disturbing story of a major and disastrous exploit that Shell Oil had trying to drill in the Arctic Ocean. And we're going to talk for a moment with Justin and Mike about why you need to support KBOO, and we'll kind of tie in some of the things that Mackenzie just been talking about some of the problems with multinational mega corporations and the fossil fuel industry. But when we come back, we're going to talk more about this particular adventure a couple of years ago that was quite a disaster for Shell. But now let's be joined by Mike and Justin and find out why and how you can become a member and supporter of this amazing experiment we call KBOO Community Radio.
Thank you, Barbara. Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Community Radio's Winter Membership Drive. And right now, you can call us at 877-500-5266 to support KBOO. I'm Mike. I'm here with Justin. Justin just had to remind me to be as enthusiastic with my energy as I actually am, because it is fun to sit down here during Membership Drive. It's fun to pick up the phone and meet the volunteers who are waiting to answer the call and support KBOO, support the type of programming that gives you the information that you want, that you need, that you thrive on. Check out this fun quote that I just found that I shared. I love sharing this one with people, and it's about this whole myth of scarcity. In 1985, the wealthiest 5% had a net worth of $8 trillion, which is a lot of money. Today, the top 5% have a net worth of $40 trillion. The top 5% have gained more wealth than the whole of the human race had created prior to 1980. Now think about that.
And think about how a modest contribution can be the antidote to this consolidation of wealth. I mean, we're going to talk about windfall here, but the real windfall is a two-way street. It's the information, the vital programming. It's the labor of love from all of our, I like to call them ambassadors. Barbara is one of our cultural ambassadors, our political ambassadors. She's spending a lot of time working to chase down these interviews, to bring you the news you're not supposed to know, and it only gets out into the community and makes that powerful difference, because the lights are on, our transmitter is functioning. For us, we've been saying, we hear all the time about follow the money. Well, we hear all money right here. It leads right back into your home, dear listener. There's nothing in between. It is transparent. So you know you can trust us, because the money is yours. It's not coming in from corporations. It's coming in from you, the listener, from you, the community member. And if you haven't done that yet, it's not so much the amount that you give, it's that you call up and get counted. Do that right now. 877-500-5266. You can do that online at kboo.fm. And we're going to hand it back to Barbara, because we want to make sure we get as much content in here as possible. But I guess we got another minute, and that's true, because I like having another minute to remind the listeners that you don't hear commercials, you don't get all that stuff, you just get news, information, and music. And so right now, you answer the call by making the call. 877-500-5266.
$60 minimum pledge will get you the book that our guest, Mr. Funk, has written called Windfall. Global warming's physical impacts can be separated into three broad categories: melt, drought, and deluge. And Funk travels to 24 countries to profile entrepreneurial people who see each of these factors in a potential windfall. So that's some of the great information that you're going to find. If you pledge a minimum of $60, you can pick up the phone right now and dial 877-500-5266.
Well, I just want to reminisce for a moment. A year ago in our last winter pledge drive, Mackenzie Funk actually drove down to the station from Seattle in a snowstorm to be on live, and that was right when Windfall was coming out. He now has a new ebook out. It's a short book, about 40 pages, well worth reading, called Of Ice and Men, which is what we're talking about today. But I highly recommend getting a hold of Windfall. It's a really disturbing book written with a bit of a sense of humor about some of the outrageous advantages that certain people are taking in the face of climate change. So we're talking this morning with Mackenzie Funk, who is the author of a new ebook, Of Ice and Men, about a disastrous experience that Shell Oil had in the Arctic a couple years ago, and how it doesn't seem to be stopping them from continuing to be determined to drill in the Arctic. Mackenzie, let's talk about let's talk about the plans that Shell had to go ahead and drill in the Arctic Sea, and what did it entail?
They had plans to do a bunch of exploration wells, so test wells up in Chukchi and Beaufort Seas, which are sort of wrap around Alaska. The Chukchi is between Russia and Alaska, and the Beaufort is basically straight above, and we share the Beaufort with Canada. And this is extremely far away from Seattle, which is where they had their fleet doing some repairs in a shipyard here. How far? I mean, we're talking the distance, I think, from here to Dutch Harbor, which is the farthest north we have a deep water port in the United States, is about 2,000 miles. And then it's another 1,000 or more to get to these leases up in the Arctic, where they're going to do their drilling. So it's an incredible distance. And the Arctic is such that you can't rely on any infrastructure. I mean, there are a few villages, whaling villages, the Inupiat Eskimo whaling villages, that are along the coastline there. But really, there's no spill response. There are not many roads. There are no connecting roads. There are a few airstrips. There's nothing, really, for an oil company to keep it safe from any accidents. So they had to bring everything. And we're talking a fleet of maybe 20 ships. And they have to drag, in particular, these drill rigs up there. Or one drill rig needed to be dragged, and one was a converted ship, so it was on its own power. The famous drill rig for Shell was called the Kulik. And it was just this massive, massive, like, buoy. That's what it looks like, except it's 300 feet tall. And it weighs half as much as the Titanic. And they dragged this all the way up to Alaska, through some of the most treacherous waters on Earth, and then back. And that's really where they ran into trouble.
Now, they also were trying to do this during a very short window of time, because isn't the Arctic up there frozen, or at least have a huge amount of sea ice throughout most of the year?
Yeah, very good point. So they would perhaps prefer to stay longer, but they were given a permit by the Obama administration. In fact, Obama himself seems to have intervened in the election year, 2012, wanted to see if Shell could go up and find that oil up there. And so they were trying to get up there very quickly before the sea ice returns. And I think October 15th is when they had to stop drilling. And the ice wasn't gone until July. And so they had this tiny window to get up there. And that's one of the big issues in the Arctic, is as much as it's melting, it's still not gone, the sea ice. It's still there seasonally. And it can be thick and dangerous. In this part of the Arctic, they had at one point started drilling one of these test wells, and a giant ice floe about the size of Manhattan came close to the drill ship, and they had to pull up everything and then get out of the way, and they didn't start drilling again for another 2 weeks. But even before they started getting up there, they were having problems. They were having sort of a quick rush job on some refurbishments that they were doing to the ships. They needed to have a spill barge that was after Deepwater Horizon mandated, not mandated, but suggested to Shell that they should have a true spill barge with a blowout preventer in one of those caps, like happened with Deepwater Horizon, and they should be able to bring that up there. They were still testing that into July and August in 2012. And when they finally had it done, it was almost too late to drag it all the way up there. You know, it was a 20-day, even 30-day trip to get it into position. So they weren't even allowed to go for oil in the summer of 2012. They were just allowed to drill maybe 1,000 feet down into the seabed, prepare everything, and then leave this top hole, as it was called. And then they were going to be able to continue the job the next summer, except that didn't happen.
So let's talk a little bit about the disastrous trip back to Seattle.
So Shell had its fleet part of the time in, in Dutch Harbor, which is in the Aleutian Islands. It's about halfway through the Aleutians, halfway to Russia, and is just on the edge of the Gulf of Alaska, which is a very treacherous waters, especially in wintertime. Shell had taken so long to get out of the Arctic that they weren't back in the Dutch harbor until November, late November. And then they decided, let's go for it. Let's drag these ships down to Alaska down to Seattle for some off-season repairs. And so they attached the Kulik to its tugboat and dragged it across the Gulf of Alaska on December 21st they left. This is one of the most treacherous seas, arid gulfs, in the middle of winter when the storms are the worst. And one reason they did this is that they would be taxed if they were in an Alaskan port. On January 1, 2013, there would be a small tax on their rig.
Small,
I say, because it's probably $5 or $6 million, which the entire project at this point has cost them almost $6 billion. So it's not much, and yet they decided they would tow it before the new year, in part for that reason. And then they towed it out, and very quickly, this rig, which is shaped like this buoy. Not really meant to be dragged back and forth, especially not in giant storms, was hit by four storms in a row. It would probably be considered cyclones outside of Alaska. And it was sort of going back and forth like a top, like a dreidel, just spinning around and then gyrating horribly, and then it snapped. The tow line snapped, and it was adrift with 18 men on it. And a long period of attempting to reconnect it and reconnect it and reconnect it, and they would do it. The line would break again until finally it crashed into the rocks near Kodiak Island in Alaska.
Now, this whole event was being watched very carefully by environmental activists around the world. And I recall, though I didn't know the details until I read your book, but I recall this was a big test in a way in the eyes of Greenpeace and other groups to show that it was actually really not feasible to drill for oil in the Arctic, despite the leases that Shell had been given, and that Shell was also not the right company to be doing it. And what were these groups, what were they watching, and what were they reporting back?
Well, interestingly, there were so many groups working on this issue. The drilling in the Arctic is something like tar sands, where lots of people are interested for different reasons. So you had everything from native groups and Alaskan groups like Alaskan Wilderness to NRDC, Greenpeace, Sierra Club. Everyone's united in the idea that they don't like Shell drilling. And Greenpeace in particular was up there. They had their ice-hardened ship, and they were going to go up there and intercept Shell in the Chukchi Sea. And I actually joined them. I was trying to embed and to watch this interception in the summer of 2012, and because Shell was so delayed with all its engineering problems, Greenpeace had this somewhat comical, just driving around in circles with no one to intercept and nothing to stop. But the idea was to have eyeballs on Shell, because the thing about working in such a remote place is that if something goes wrong, nobody knows it. And it turns out lots of things did go wrong, and they were hidden until this crash and until a subsequent Coast Guard investigation. But they were looking to see. When Greenpeace was up there, they were looking to see, okay, what's here in this part of the Chukchi Sea? Is this a dead sea? What kind of damage are we doing when drilling here? And one thing that many people know is that the Chukchi is home to about half of America's polar bears. And They have enough problems as the ice is pulling back. It's also walruses, and then there's stuff on the seafloor that, you know, not just crabs, but all sorts of life. So they were looking to see basically how would they be dumping water with, like, you know, oily water into the sea. Well, actually, yes, they were. They just pled guilty to 8 felony charges for that. And would they really be moving out of the way for the ice? You know, would they be able to fly their helicopters? The answer is no, not really. They had Gulf of Mexico helicopter pilots and helicopters that didn't have the de-icing equipment that you'd need to fly in the Arctic. And they had ships and crews from the Gulf of Mexico who didn't have a lot of experience in the Arctic. And then they had basically a lot of Southerners up in a place that tests even the best, most experienced Alaskan mariners. And not that Greenpeace has necessarily any more experience up there. I wouldn't say that they were any more safe than Shell would be up in the Chukchi. But it does show that it's just a tough operating environment.
Well, we're talking this morning with Mackenzie Funk, who is author of an e-book called Of Ice and Men, about a disastrous effort that Shell made trying to drill oil in the Arctic Ocean. And we're going to return and finish talking with Mackenzie in just a few moments. But in the meantime, going to be joined by Justin and Mike, who want to tell you why you need to support KBOO.
Thanks so much, Barbara. My name's Justin. I am joined by Mike, and I'm thrilled to report that we have just entered a matching period for the remaining 20 minutes of Locus Focus. Zinc Associates has made a generous offer to match the next $365 that come in from our dear listeners in Radioland. Pick up your phone right now, and your money will be doubled without any extra work on your part. That's 877-500-5266. 877-500-KBOO. Think about it. If you were willing to start or renew a monthly deduction at the $60 level, we can get you a copy of Windfall, The Booming Business of Global Warming, and your donation will become $120. If you wanted to do that hoodie at a modest $240 over the year, that's a $20 monthly deduction, that would become $480. So please, right now, there's never been a better time to say thank you to Barbara Bernstein for her tireless efforts to bring you news and information you're not supposed to know. She's been doing this for a long time. That doesn't make her old. It makes her experienced and wise in the ways of journalism. Call us right now, 877-500-KBOO.
And you can find us on Twitter at KBOO. Send us your thoughts, support, and questions there. You can follow our page on Facebook for the latest updates and about giveaways during the drive. And in Twitter, search for hashtag support KBOO and read great tweets from our supporters. For example, Pat by the River writes, so excited about Mardi Gras special on KBOO today. Well, it's not the Mardi Gras special today, but we're in the middle of the winter membership drive. We're well on the way to meeting our goals, and we've got goals that's happening right now. We want to reach that $750, and you can help make that happen by picking up your phone and dialing 877-500-5266. If you're in the area, you can stop by and visit us at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, right off of 8th and Burntide. And if you're online, you can go to kboo.fm.
You know, Barbara, I was thinking that at the beginning of the interview, we were hearing about essentially growth as an end in and of itself, which is really a different model from the KBOO model, where I think of it as growth is a means to increase the level of service that we can provide. And this sort of radio university, whereby on the one hand, we're training volunteers to become citizen journalists, citizen activists. And on the other hand, we are educating, empowering, and informing our listeners. So it's kind of a university in all the ways. And that's one of the reasons we ask people to show some support. The amount isn't so critical. It's that you stand up and be counted. 877-500-5266. Barbara, did you want to jump in on that?
Sure. Once again, the number to call is 1-877-500-5266. You know, I was thinking about, as you guys were talking and giving out the Twitter handle and things like that, I ran into this man in Oaks Bottom the other day when I was out there walking, and he recognized my voice, or he said, "You sound familiar," and I told him I was on KBOO, and he recognized who I was, and I offered to give him send him an email regularly about when the show's on, because I send out emails every week. If you want to do that, you should just you can get on my email list. So he said, no, I don't have email. I'm very 20th century. I go to the library once a week and go online at the library. And I was thinking how, at the one hand, KBOO is really reaching out towards all these people who are really engaged in social media. But we also, I want to assure those of you who are closer to my age and Justin's age, and maybe who don't even have email yet, that we're here for you too. We're this old-fashioned format radio, where you turn on a dial, you turn on a button and move the dial, and there it comes out of your speakers, and it's in real time, and it's people that are in your neighborhood, in your community, who are producing it. So this is kind of a shout out for all of you old fogies who don't want to join the social media age. KBOO is still here for you, and you can join us by calling 877-500-5266.
It's true, we swing both ways, as it were, and right now we're in a matching period, and that means that a Zinc Associates is going to match the next $365 that come in. We have a couple of phone lines open, about 15 minutes to do it. Remember, the real number here is $85,000. That's how much your community radio station needs to continue this radio university serving everyone. So please, you can do that online at kboo.fm. But there's no music like hearing the sound of ringing phones during the membership drive. So as we get ready to hand it back to Barbara here, please don't wait for someone else to do it. The time is now and the opportunity is yours, particularly during this matching period, thanks to Zinc Associates. Call right now, toll free, 877-500-KBOO.
And I just want to say that we are supported by Zinc Associates and not by Shell Oil. And that's the difference between those community businesses who support KBOO and do it through matching grants, or do it through giving us food during our pledge drive, or do it through underwriting. But it's a real big difference than the corporation that we're talking about this morning that is trying to drill oil in the Arctic. So we're talking this morning with Mackenzie Funk, who has written a new ebook called Of Ice and Men, about the disastrous efforts that Shell Oil attempted 2 years ago to start drilling in the Arctic. And we were just... Mackenzie was describing just how disastrous it was. We haven't gotten into what happened to the rig yet. So let's talk about... what happened to the Kulik? What happened to that containment dome that never made it up there? And where does that leave Shell now?
Well, that containment dome apparently got finished too late for it to be of any use to anyone. And it is currently in, as far as I can tell, in Vancouver, BC, and the ship itself is in dry docks, and they're preparing it. In fact, Seattle has just agreed to let Shell have its fleet stay here and overwinter here and be based here. Shell has leased a new rig to replace the Kulik, which I'll get into what happened to the Kulik in a moment. They've got their other rig, which is a former log carrier. It's almost 50 years old. And those same two drill ships, or same configuration of drill ships, are going to, in theory, go up there again in 2015. And let me get into why I'm not sure it's actually going to happen. But first I'll say the Kulik itself slammed into the rocks on December 31st of 2012. I was actually in Portland when it happened. I remember it was a new baby, and so we were not really doing anything exciting for New Year's, but we were at a friend's house, and I was waiting for him to fall asleep. And I was looking at my phone, reading about it. I heard the Shell drill rig was loose and about to, they were trying to capture it, and it was already on the front pages of some papers that Shell had lost its major Arctic drill rig, and it was floating about in the Gulf of Alaska. And then around 8 p.m. came the news. It actually slammed into the rocks, and I thought it was $6 billion down the drain, it seemed to me at the time. I flew up there a few days afterwards to see what they tried to do next, which was to pull it off the rocks. And they actually refloated it and put it in an adjacent bay, and then sat it there for a long time, trying to decide what to do, I think, and where to go. They ended up putting it on this giant heavy lift ship, a ship big enough to carry this giant drill rig, believe me, is a massive thing, and took it to Asia, where it was eventually broken down and sold for scrap in a shipyard last year in south of Shanghai in China. I had thought this was probably the beginning of the end for Shell, because it was such an eyesore for them. And this was something that was all over the newspapers, in front page of the New York Times, internationally, internationally really, any time someone would mention Shell drilling in the Arctic, you'd just see this stock photo taken by the Coast Guard, they would show their drill rigs sitting there getting pounded by waves on the beach. And I thought, they're not going to recover from this. Especially when oil prices got so low that the Arctic became uneconomic. At today's oil prices, really anything below $70 a barrel, it does not make any sense, even from a pure capitalistic idea, to drill up there in Chukchi. And yet, about a week and a half ago, Shell announced that they are planning to return in 2015 if they can get the permission. And I honestly don't know what that means. Is that just that they don't want to tell investors that their $6 billion adventure in the North is over? Or are they actually going to go up there again? And I guess we'll find out in the coming months if they really do mobilize this fleet. You know, right now, their drill ship is in Singapore. One of them is. Doesn't seem to be moving, but eventually it's going to be coming here to Seattle. They just fleece that, and then we'll see.
But
if it's like...
Go ahead.
We'll probably know by March or April, because they've got a few legal challenges to deal with, and they've got to get permission, sign off from the administration on its permits. So the real question is whether the Obama administration is going to let them, for one thing, and whether the judges looking at the there's lawsuits are going to let them. But in the meantime, they're mobilizing.
Well, it seems that there's some confusion, you know, from an ordinary news follower, that what's going on and where is it allowed to drill in the Arctic and where not? Because there was news also last week that Obama has expanded the reserves along the Arctic National Wildlife
right.
Refuge, where there's no drilling allowed. But then quietly, there seem to be these other drilling sites that are still going to be leased. And I'm not sure if that was being expanded or if it's just the same ones that Shell had.
Yeah, so what's happened is that the Obama administration put certain areas off limits to forever, or at least they're proposing to do so, to drilling. And some of these are in the Chukchi Sea and some are in the Beaufort, the two areas where Shell wanted to drill. But they are very specifically not the leases that Shell already holds. I was there in 2008 when Shell bid $2.1 billion in Anchorage, in a strange sort of silent auction lease sale that happened in Anchorage. And they spent that much money just for the right to drill in this one part of the Chukchi. And so they absolutely still have those leases. And those leases will expire after a while if Shell doesn't actually start producing oil. And so I think no one really knows. And it may be that even Shell doesn't know what they're going to do. It could be they're saying, well, let's get everything ready so that if we do somehow get permission to go up there. And they need permission from basically a sign-off on their drilling plan. They're going to have X amount of ships and that they're going to have this much safety equipment. They do need the administration to sign off on that. And in addition, there's an environmental impact statement about what would happen up there in the Chukchi that was challenged in court. And they need that case to be resolved. But if those two things happen, they could, in theory, begin drilling this summer.
What do you think is working against Shell's ability to ever really succeed in drilling for oil in the Arctic?
There's the micro, the lawsuits. Very few people outside of Alaska are really excited about this. I should say that in their favor, about 70% of Alaskans do want offshore oil. It's the lifeblood of the economy. So there's that political push. In the short term, there are things like these lawsuits, or things like some of the native communities are against them drilling in the ocean right off their town. And on the other hand, some are in favor. And in the longer term, there's the fact that, as recent studies have shown, if you drill any of the Arctic oil, then you're condemning us to a much warmer, sort of horrifically warmer world. And so long term, and this is a long term thing, are we really going to want that oil? I mean, oil companies look at in 50 years down the line, and if they tap oil next year, it'll be 10 years before they produce it. It'll be maybe 30 years before they're done, 40 years before they're done producing it. And so that's a very long time, and I wonder if the world's going to change fast enough to make it oil that never comes out of the ground. That would be, I think, everyone's hope, including even Shell's. They've said that if they could find a different energy mix and, of course, be the one selling it to us, they'd be happy to do so. But in the meantime, they're going to make money doing what they do. That's what they say.
Well, actually, one thing...
I think those are the long-term issues. And the other thing is just that the Arctic is really far. And even as much as the ice pulls back, the infrastructure needs in Alaska to do drilling of this sort, it's a massive endeavor. It's massively expensive. And as 2012 showed, towing ships back and forth from Seattle tows them through very dangerous waters, and things like this happen.
Well, in your book, you talk about the Trans-Alaska pipeline that is nearing the end of its useful life because the sources of oil that in Prudhoe Bay, for what the pipeline was built to transport, are drying up. And so how does that create pressure? And what are the concerns about letting this pipeline basically just deteriorate? What kind of pressure has that created within Alaska to explore for more oil in the Arctic?
Well, there's basically the entire state economy is built on oil. I think it's something like 90% of the government revenue. If you look at news out of Alaska, even in recent days, it's just about shutdown of government services. One of them, they recently shut down all bars on the ferries because they were losing money. I don't know how bar selling alcohol actually loses money, but somehow they were doing so. So they've closed all the bars on the ferries, which people took as a real sign of distress. You know, it's the beginning of a budget crisis in Alaska, which has never in recent memory had anything of the sort because they always had so much oil money. So there's the sort of Alaskan way of life, which is you don't pay taxes so much as get money back from the government just for being Alaskan, is going away. And that's creating a lot of pressure on the politicians there. And the Trans-Alaska pipeline, as you say, it's running at lower and lower capacity as they pump less oil out of Prudhoe Bay.
Actually, Mackenzie, we're actually out of time. So,
okay.
I'm sorry we started to hold up the subject. We're going to have to continue this conversation another time.
No problem.
But anyway, I want to thank you very much for joining us.
No problem.
And we've been talking with Mackenzie Funk, who's author of Ice and Men. And now we're going to talk some more with Justin and Mike about why you need to help support KBOO.
Thanks so much. My name is Justin. I'm here with Mike, and it is our winter membership drive, and we have about 4 minutes left in our matching period, thanks to Zinc Associates. So we're hoping a few more of you going to call right now, double your money without any extra effort on your part. That's toll-free, 877-500-5266, 877-500-KBOO. Thanks to Gary in Portland for renewing, Frank in Beaverton for renewing, and Tim in Albany for renewing. We're grateful. Now, right now, let's have three new members. Let's add three new members to the KBOO Good Book and take advantage of this matching period. Make sure that Barbara reaches her goal. We've got just a few hundred dollars to go, and people are moving to their phones right now. 877-500-5266.
Or you can go online, donate at KBOO.FM, KBOO.org. You can start a monthly deduction from your bank account, credit, or debit card. Our auto deduction plan is very secure, super convenient. Every $1,000 a month that we can increase, we are able to take one day off the membership drive every year. The best way to provide stable funding for KBOO, around 40% of our members contribute via EFT, electronic funds transfer, so it's a super convenient way to do so. We will accept cash if you come down here, if you're in the neighborhood.
We accept cash?
Can we
get some cash? I think we will accept. We're going to make an exception here and
okay.
accept cash.
I mean,
cash.
If you're in the neighborhood and you're at 20 Southeast 8th, right off of 8th and Burnside, I might be wrong about that. Okay.
No, I'm pretty sure we're going to accept cash.
But I want to encourage you guys that are in the neighborhood to stop on in and say hello and become a member of KBOO. You know what I'm saying?
60 U.S. American dollars gets you a copy of Windfall, the booming business of global warming. We're asking you to do that, and that $60 becomes $120 when you take advantage of our match. 877-500-5266. Zinc Associates have done what they can do today. Barbara has clearly done what she can do today for the community. Kate is running the board. Mike is here pitching with. Everyone has done what they can do today. Now you, dear listener, pennies, nickels, and dimes, times. That's what it takes for you to do all you can for the community. You engage in a little checkbook activism when you call 877-500-5266. Your money's getting doubled. Please don't just watch that go by. That's not the kind of person you are. That's why you listen to KBOO. You don't listen to the shrieking heads on the right side of the dial. You listen to savvy programming designed to bring you news and information to enrage, educate, enthuse, enlighten, entertain. And that's why you're not going to let this moment go by. 877-500-5266.
To agitate, to aggravate, to encourage you to play a part, to play your role, to be accountable, be responsible, man. Pick up the piece of this thing that we're all carrying moving forward to make society more just, more equitable, to keep people more informed, to elevate the consciousness of the listener in the community. Those phones are ringing right now. It sounds good. It sounds good to hear people reaching out to support KBOO. Pick up your phone. You got a cell phone. You got an old rotary phone. Whatever it is, communicate. Give us a shout. 877-500-5266.
Thanks, Justin, and thanks, Mike, and thanks for everybody who's called. This morning, we were talking with Mackenzie Funk, who's author of Ice and Men, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in, you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locusfocus. Next week, we'll talk with Marie Mockett, author of Where the Dead Pause and the Japanese Say Goodbye. My engineer is Kate Welch. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by the Pentangle about another disastrous trip to the Arctic. Thanks for listening.
I dreamed a dream and I thought it true, concerning Franklin and his gallant crew.
And you are tuned to KBOO Portland. And it is 11 a.m. Coming up is Health Watch with host Dr. David Naiman. He speaks with Sally Fallon Morell about her book, Nourishing Broth, an Old-Fashioned Remedy for a Modern World. And stay tuned at 11:30. We speak with Portlander David J. Morris, author of the new book, The Evil Hours, a biography of post-traumatic stress disorder. So do stay tuned to your community radio and make that call to make your pledge as soon as you can.
What motivated you to decide to support KBOO Community Radio?
It's great to have a voice that represents the community and that is an alternative to the corporate voice. And I think that, you know, the way the world is changing, I mean, it's just so important that people get activated.